we'll start with this second forum on the global economy, which is more focused on structured and analysis on the trends and challenges before us, in which we have the huge luck of having Bart van Ark, Martina Larkin, Belén Romana, and Eric Cheney with us, to whom we'd like to thank for sharing their knowledge with all of us. Very, very briefly, let me talk a little bit about their prolific careers. Professor Bart van Ark is an economics PhD from the Groningen University. He started working in the UK College of Economics, and he's been working in the Conference Board in New York. In 2020, he became the president of productivity at the university, and he's also an advisor of the Círculo Empresarios. Welcome. A degree in finance from Sandel and Fordham Universities, an MBA from ESB Europe, and a world fellow. Martina Larkin started working at Nestle Switzerland before becoming a part of the World Economic Forum, where she was in charge of the EMEA area. A year ago, she became an independent advisor for the technological environment for the European Union, and she's in charge of foreign relations and Scale Up Europe. She is also a member of the Advisory Council of the Círculo Belén Romana, has a degree of the Universidad Autónoma de Madrid, and a state economist. She worked for the Ministry of Economics and the Director of the Treasury and Financial Policy. She also was the president of the Sareb and the Círculo Empresarios, and she is currently an independent advisor for Santander, ASICS, and the BME Group as a member of the Digital Future Society Board. And not less important, she's an advisory counselor for the Fundación Rafael del Pino. And Eric Cheney started their career at the Universidad Nacional de Estadística in France before joining Morgan Stanley, where he became head economist for Europe. He also was the head economist for AXA. And 4 years ago, he created his own consultancy firm, and he works for the Montaigne Institute. He's been a professor of economy for Strasbourg University and Paris Tech. He's also an advisor for many organizations, among which we can recount the Círculo de Empresarios. I am very happy to have you with all of us. I won't go overboard, and we will just start. We have seen that the crisis that came from the pandemic has left scars on our economies, which will take a long time to heal over, and that this recovery can have its silver lining and its issues. We now find ourselves in a situation at the end of the 2008 crisis, given the economic policies we chose and the political situation found ourselves. So let's take a look at the structural trends and challenges we'll have in the long run. So we asked Professor Bart van Ark to focus on productivity, Martina Larkin to focus on innovation and technology, Belén Romana to talk about corporate commitment, and Eric Cheney to discuss and analyze all matters related to the environment and growth. So let's start with you, Professor Bart van Ark. I would like to know what you think of productivity at a time in which we are seeing how previously this achievement of this sweet moment we are tasting, in which we can see a solution for the problems brought forth by COVID-19. We've seen a growth of productivity based on digitalization, but we don't know what lays beyond this. What effects will this process have when it comes to digitalization? So we'd like to know, what are productivity perspectives? Will there still be gaps? Why are the U.S. and European Union, which all these emerging economies, when it comes to political and economy, especially when we take a look at the evolution in Spain, when such a modest situation.
Oh, thank you for the nice introductions. And thank you, actually, at a lot of firsts during this time. And this is actually my first international business trip since 18 months. So it's like quite an experience to make the trip and to do things that you've been thinking as quite normal 18 months ago. So here we are again. So thank you for that. I want to take you up on this invitation to talk a little bit about productivity and tag on to actually one of the last comments that were just made in the previous panel on working from home and productivity and digital transformation. And I will start from two premises. The first premise is that I do believe that during the pandemic, digital technology has actually quite important to get us through. It could have been much worse without digital technology. And in fact, productivity growth during a pandemic after adjustments actually hasn't been all that bad. Certainly not as bad as the collapses we've seen in GDP and in employment and things like that. So that's my first premise. The second premise is that coming out of this pandemic, there is a real opportunity to continue to use digital technology as a way to support productivity growth. But we have to be really careful to get this right, because if we don't get this right, I would worry about digital technology to actually become a source of greater inequality in our society and the benefits of productivity ending up with even a fewer group of people, companies, and businesses and places around the world. So those are the two premises I want to talk about for a few minutes. So let's start with the good news. As I mentioned, you know, under the pandemic, we've seen these huge declines in GDP. In Spain, we lost more than 11% of GDP, I believe, almost as many workers. Productivity sort of remained about the same as it was before. It was basically zero. Now, some of that is related, as we all know, to the fact that we shut down the least productive sectors in the economy, hospitality and recreational services and so on. But we do know from some research that I've been involved with myself that indeed companies that are the most digitally transformed companies were the companies that actually were much better equipped during this crisis than companies that had not started this journey on digital transformation. And we do see that from research on looking at particular industries, but we also see it at research looking at particular companies. Now, there are various factors that that explain this. By digital advanced, I actually should say, what I mean by that is more companies that have done more investments in digital technology before the pandemic, companies that had a better digitally skilled workforce, and companies that already had more experience with digital sales and online sales and online purchases in a digital fashion. So the various factors that are explaining why this is the case, of course, when we started to work from home, companies that already had a lot of digital systems in place were able to do it much quicker. People got at home, were able to access their systems. They got much faster the skills and the equipment they needed to do this. They were able to move even faster to almost 100% online sales models, as was the case for quite a while. And they also were better able to deal with some of the resilience issues that we were having in the economy and in the supply chains. But it was not only in the private sector, also in the public sector, we saw that, for example, educational institutions and schools who had done more in digital before the pandemic were actually able to serve their students better. And even in the healthcare sector, which obviously was deeply, deeply hurt by this crisis, we actually have seen changes in digital technologies. Think, for example, the move to telemedicine, changes that wouldn't have been made for years if the pandemic had not happened. So that's all the good news. People sometimes ask if I think that the pandemic will actually, and that this application of this digital technology will now actually get us to grow productivity faster. I don't think I want to be too optimistic about it, but I quite often will answer the question. We probably took things a few years forward. We just made a level change and we did things faster than we would have done otherwise. And obviously that's a win. So that's all the good news. Now the concerning part. It seems very clear that not everyone, not every person, not every worker, not every company, not every place, if you look at the regional component, not everyone has benefited in the same way from the intensive use of technology during the pandemic. Digital inequalities are not new. We had them well before the crisis. But the key concern is that in the last 18 months, these digital inequalities have actually become bigger. Some people couldn't work from home and still had to go to work in order to make their living. Some people had to work from home but didn't have good access to internet or had to deal with, you know, small places to live in where they also had to homeschool their children. Students were quite often not able to have the right equipment in order to follow their education online. And also small businesses struggled a lot more than larger businesses, quite often, many of them in remote places, not having good access to the internet, and also had much harder time to adjust to online sales models. They definitely learned very quickly, and it's amazing what kind of changes have been made, but a lot of the changes were tactical rather than strategic. And therefore, the question is, what kind of these digital models that were introduced will actually continue after the crisis and continue to drive productivity? Now, again, nothing of this is new. We had some of this before the crisis, but I think in this recovery, what we worry about is what has been called this K-shaped recovery, right? We do have an overall recovery, but if you look in a bit more detail, there are some companies, some people, some regions that are on the upper part of the K, but there are other companies and people and regions actually on the lower part of the K, and as a result, the gap will actually become larger. And I think if that's going to really happen, we might actually end up in a worse place rather than in a better place with all of this. Which really brings me then to my second premise, and that is that we need to manage this recovery well in order to prevent that rising inequality happening from digital transformation to make that happen. And for that, I think we should focus on productivity, but I would add a term to that, and that is an adjective to that, and that is inclusive productivity. Now, you always have to be careful if you add an adjective to a noun, right? You all know this. We talk about green growth or sustainable development, and then you immediately ask, well, what does that exactly mean? So what does inclusive productivity mean? Because narrowly defined, productivity is just kind of an efficiency measure. You do kind of more with less. But inclusive productivity means we do more, but we do it in a different way. We do it better, we do it smarter, and as a result, the gains of productivity will reach more people. We can grow more, we can involve more people in the process of growth and make them more productive. And this is really important because we are now living, interestingly, in a period of time where on the one hand, we still have a large number of people out of employment. You know, and Spain is a good example, and we just mentioned the example of the U.S., where we have 7 million more people still out of the labor force before the crisis. But at the same time, companies are screaming for workers, and not just in the most digitally intensive sectors, but truck drivers and people in warehouses and so on. So we're in this very strange situation that there is actually a labor force out there, but at the same time, we're actually not able to actually get them very quickly in. So we need to do a few things to really begin to reduce these digital inequalities in order to attract more people into the labor market and get them on a sort of more productive track. Now, the first, of course, is to improve digital skills. And there's still a lot of work to do, both inside the workplace as well as outside the workplace. It will make it easier for people to become more flexible, to become more productive, and companies can do a lot here. Because, you know, we quite often think this is the education system or the government who has to do this. But companies can do a lot in terms of changing and improving training on the job floor, And learning on the job is really very important, but business leaders need to be strategic about it. There are great programs to set up mentor systems, but at the same time, new workers, and quite often younger workers, can come in the company and bring in new ideas. We also know that if you increase more diversity in your company by bringing in younger people, by increasing the gender balance, by bringing in ethnic minorities, you actually see a good impact on productivity, provided that you work on it and you do the things in order to skill the workforce. But companies don't have to do this on their own, because we're actually all in the same boat. And quite often the thinking is that, you know, if I invest in skills and additional skills of my workforce, the next day they will run away to my competitor who may just offer a little bit more. But the competitor, of course, is in the same boat. So this is the typical catch-22 situation. If we all think that people will be poached, then in the end we will do nothing. So we have to sort of collectively work on this, because ultimately it will allow you to see some good people go, but also to see perhaps even some better people coming back to your company. So you don't have to do this alone. You can do this with other companies. And again, here, actually, schools and government can also be a part of the mix. We do know that when companies work together in a local area with the school system, and particularly with the technical and vocational schools, we do actually have opportunities to train people more effectively, to create apprenticeships and so on. And that will help to actually advance the skills of the workforce quite significantly. And government can play a role, particularly when it deals with the group of people who are most difficult to reach, the people who are disadvantaged in terms of having access to the internet, who don't have the resources to invest in their own education, and so on and so forth. So finally, and then I'll stop, we of course also need better measures of what productivity now, what inclusive productivity exactly is. And that's perhaps where some of my own work at the Productivity Institute in the UK comes in. You know, we can't just measure output in the way that we're doing it today as just, you know, counting what business is producing. Because a lot of what we produce is actually not easy to measure. Free content of digital goods and services are not very well picked up in the statistics. And even things that we do measure, like healthcare output, we measure it the wrong way. We still measure a lot of our healthcare output as, you know, the number of people we have in hospital beds. Whereas what we should actually be measuring, of course, is how quickly we get people out of these beds and back on their feet. Or perhaps even better, how do we prevent people from actually going to the healthcare system in the first place because they are living a more healthy life. So there's a lot of work to be done on improving these measures of output and these measures of productivity. And that is, of course, where we also need to be part. What you measure is ultimately what you can manage. So in sum, coming out of the pandemic, I think the choice is between a recovery for all or a recovery for some. And I think that's a very important choice. Digital technologies can help a lot in order to make it a recovery for all, but it will need quite significant work from the business community, from the policy community, from the educational system to reach its results. We were all in it together during the pandemic, and we sometimes tend to forget that we're still all in it together during this recovery. And if that's not going to happen, I would worry about the outcomes that we're going to get. So let's choose the positive side of this.
Muchas gracias. Estoy seguro que volveremos sobre el tema.
Thank you very much. I'm certain we'll touch back on the productivity issue. But we've actually asked Martina to start with a subject which you've already mentioned, Mr. Van Ark, because, well, the uncertainty on the future, we always think about how we can face the challenges we've got before us. We always think that the road is the use of technology, learning, using knowledge. So these aspects are key for progress, but we really find ourselves in a situation in which we really have to envision different strategies to face these challenges, this boost to technology and innovation. So could you give us your thoughts on this triangle, business, education, innovation? Because when we talk about this, we always, when we talk about education at all levels, especially higher education, when we talk with universities, co-creating solutions, all of these concepts that we have on the table, and which in this post-COVID situation, we might have to envision with different strategies.
Of course, innovation plays a central role in economic growth and as a driver of productivity. Of course, the new technologies can improve production of services and goods. But I think one of the key questions is also what kind of innovation are we talking about? There's a recent research actually by the IMF which shows that productivity has slowed down overall, but the R&D spending has gone up, which is sort of contradictory to what we inherently think, because obviously R&D spending is a proxy for innovation. So if productivity goes down, R&D spending should have gone down. And there's a possible explanation, and I think that's a very important element when we talk about innovation in tech, which is the type of research matters. Innovations, you know, the great ones and the small ones, or the big and small, of course, occur not in a vacuum, but drawn from basic research. And I think here it's important to understand that there's a difference between applied knowledge and applied research and basic research. And it's this basic research, which is really the fundamental source of a lot of multiplied efforts of innovation. Of course, the applied innovation gives us the product, the end product, but the basic research and the basic knowledge actually provides the multitude of options that we have. You know, the vaccine wasn't developed in sort of in isolation, of course. It was based on years and decades of research, of basic research. The same with, you know, the GPS system is based on Einstein's relativity theory. So, you know, then, you know, applying this to the new technology. So I think this point about fostering much more basic research is really essential. So more investments should go into this. And actually, this has been reduced by the private sector and by the public sector, particularly because I think for companies it's difficult to harness the benefits of this, because, of course, that research, once it's done, can be applied in different contexts across the world and in different industries. So it's not evident for them how they can really internalize the efforts and the ROI around basic research. And that's where I think public policy comes in, to create that environment to foster this more. And also, basic research, I think, can be a key for green growth and green tech, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that later on. But technology, I think, plays such a fundamental role when we think about the green economy. I think it needs to be invested in more. I wanted to say a few words also on the role of business, but also the EU's and Europe's and China's sort of and the US efforts. When we look at the most innovative countries around the world, five out of the top countries are based in Europe. So somehow Europe is doing something right. But at the same time, of course, as we know, the biggest tech companies come from traditionally from the US and now, of course, from China. So there needs to be, you know, a strategy for Europe where we manage to transform this innovation and the research into the companies that also create value and growth. You know that the EU has a new innovation strategy. It goes very much to the point about, you know, a more sovereign Europe. How can Europe become or remain a rule maker when it comes to new technologies like AI and, you know, facial recognition and many of the other things? Someone very senior in the US has said that the US has already lost the race around AI leadership. And if the US has lost it, probably Europe has lost it even more. But, you know, there's still, I think, room to define frameworks of how these technologies operate. And when we bring in these new green technologies, especially around more experimental technologies like adaptation to the climate and to climate and to the environment, that plays a big role. When it comes to business, I mean, you know, we've obviously seen a period of massive transformation, and we don't get those very often, I think. And there's, of course, a special aspect of this crisis in advanced economies, especially in the service industries, which is probably more hard hit, as you mentioned also, than, you know, sort of the industrial activity. And a lot of that transformation that we need will take place through innovation, but also digitization. And that digitization needs to be fostered. And companies can do a lot more around this. You know, we can provide more value, but also, you know, what is the role that the private sector can play in terms of providing more innovation, more research, but also securing and transforming jobs. You've alluded to this as well. And also income. It's not just how do we create jobs, but how do these jobs, are they good jobs, and can they, you know, are they well-paid jobs, and are they meaningful jobs in a way? So, you know, innovation can provide a lot of hope, but the business environment really needs to be created around this. Public policy can play a role in this. And the big business sector really has to be, you know, making more R&D investments. It has reduced. We've seen in the numbers that the private sector R&D investments have been reduced, and we need to have much more investments around that from the private sector. And then the second area is jobs. You know, jobs need to be created, and there are a lot of new opportunities in new fields and new domains, but these jobs really need to be more inclusive. I don't know if that's the right word in terms of, you know, using your sort of adjectives, but they definitely need to take different shapes in the future. They will need to be more flexible. They need to, you know, speak to different people in different ways, and hopefully, you know, we can also catalyze on some of the new developments like digitization and greening of the economy to place those jobs in those areas where we think the future lies and where we want to see growth in the future.
La verdad es que las últimas palabras de Martina conectan precisamente con
Martina's latest words connect very well with what you said, which is the role companies play in society. Another one of the trends which we mentioned and which has been accelerated, all this debate on all environmental matters, social aspects, and corporate governance, what we call the ESG framework. Belén, I would like to go into this subject with you, Garmin, citizenship. Right now, they are focusing on new regulation even in these respects. So could you give us your thoughts on the impact this might have of this movement, all these outlooks? These are an opportunity, a challenge. Which would the implications be for corporate governance?
Thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to see people in person once again and to be back to these institutions that I've always felt very close to. About your question, there are several things I want to talk about, but thinking about how to structure this, first of all, the role of businesses, which are undergoing a very deep transformation. Number two, the impact of everything related to sustainability on the business world. And another topic that keeps emerging, first of all, is clearly the complexity. The next one is the change in the price of capital, a change in the flows of the financial markets, the impact on the governance of companies, and an impact on new businesses. So this is the logical structure I would like to talk about. As far as the role of companies, we all know Friedman in the 70s defined companies as an organization that has to devote itself exclusively to maximizing the well-being or wealth of its shareholders. A new body that is not very suspicious, which is the American Business Association in August of 2010 defined the role of companies, which, and it's a definition which is far, has many more multiple factors. They started talking about not just shareholders, but also customers, the environment, of course, employees, of course, society as a whole, so that the American Association of Businesses a few years ago, almost 3 years ago, tried a new definition of the role of companies. This attempt, furthermore, has been ongoing. They're already talking about consumer capitalism. What does that mean? Companies need to maximize the well-being of their customers. That's one possibility. The other possibility is this other one. Companies need to maximize their positive role on the environment in a very broad sense, not just physically, but also as far as society and governance. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We're living in a society which is clearly concerned about this new phenomenon, which is not just global warming, but the excess of waste. Clearly, the developed countries generate huge volumes of waste that cannot be replicated in the rest of the world, because then it would completely collapse. The planet would collapse, and the islands of plastic have a lot to do with the waste management of mostly Western countries. And these have generated the fact that we sent mostly to China until China said we don't want any more. And then we started thinking, well, maybe we need to do something about this. So society as a whole has this ongoing discussion. And there's a kind of general feeling that we need to start doing things in a different way. And companies play an essential role. And that's practically the case for almost everything. And I think that's very positive for companies, in my opinion. So how is this going to impact the framework? It's going to affect financing, company governance, and new business models. Number one, this has already been mentioned very often throughout today's session. One of the most serious problems we have when we talk about sustainability is we don't really know what that means. And the problem is there isn't a single universally accepted measure. We need to measure lots of different things that are very difficult to measure, and everyone's coming up with their own metrics. We need to measure the environmental aspect, which is the one most developed, but the social aspect is very difficult to measure. The impact on society is very difficult to measure. So there are multiple factors, many of which are very difficult to measure, and furthermore, there are no uniform criteria. And in this geopolitical race of how we're going to be defining this, it's the same as when we define how to measure financial flows. No one thinks that each one individually in their company is going to measure financial flows as they deem best, whether it's a P&L account or the balance sheet. There are strict metrics that are generally accepted that allow something that is extremely important, which is comparisons. And even when it's not perfect, there's a way of translating those measures. So this is so obvious, and no one would think of, you know, it doesn't matter, let's all measure whatever we want. No, it would never occur to anyone to do that. So it's very clear on financial flows. We're going to need to have a uniform, comparable way to measure the sustainable aspects. Right now, there's a huge tangle of institutions that are proposing different ways of measuring. The European Union with a taxonomy and a certain definition. World Economic Forum trying to create a series of homogeneous guidelines. Then there's SASB, TCFB. In other words, there's a huge tangle of institutions trying to get involved in this battle, which in my opinion is essential. If anyone knows anything about accounting, knows that IFR, that is different, can absolutely change the financial figures of a company. So this will be the same, and that's why I think it's geopolitical, and that's why I think the United States and also China said, yes, I want to get involved too. I'm going to decide it according to my own interests. Number two, the second effect. This is already having an effect on the financial markets and therefore on the financial structure of a company from any perspective. If you look at equity, asset managers are being very active in terms of, I want to come up with investment packages which are ESG driven or resilient. The biggest investor in the world, Larry Fink from BlackRock, has been saying for several years, I'm very serious about this. And furthermore, I want you to tell me that I want companies to report their ESG figures. And I also want to know who to complain to if this is not complied with. This is a letter to investors from Larry Fink this year. So as far as equity investors, we have large investors, the big, large investors saying, this is an element that I'm going to be taking into account. So obviously, this is quite considerable, but not just equity, but also fixed income markets. The one that's grown the most in the world is the one of green bonds. For example, the European Union is financing a big part of the new generation funds with an issuance of green bonds. All countries say, well, I want to sign up for that too. So the fixed income market is also being directly affected by these criteria, but also banking for several reasons. Number one, banks themselves are having to explain at the, for example, ECB is going to do a stress testing exercise related to climate change. This year, the PRA, which is the solvency authority in the United Kingdom, is also doing a stress test on banks and also insurance companies. So banks themselves are going to have to answer the question, it's in your whole value chain, what's the impact on ESG? Not just your business, because, well, as a service, you don't pollute very much, but your actual full value chain, which obviously also includes credit risk and therefore those funded by the bank. So from a financial perspective, I don't care the tranche of financing you look at. It's already being affected, impacted by ESG. As far as company governance, if there is something that has really shot up, and I don't think it has anything to do with the pandemic, is political activism. Political activism is also affecting companies. So I'm going to give you several examples. For example, ExxonMobil lost to board members in the hands of an activist. Chevron, in their board of directors on spot, they voted in favor of a proposal, which was not a proposal of the board, but of one of the shareholders present, to carry out a policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Anyone in that company, I can imagine the situation, and what would you do in that case? It was really impressive. But not just that. For example, Shell has been subject to a court ruling in the Netherlands. Shell had promised to reduce carbon emissions by 2050. An activist thought that 2050 was too far away. They took this to court, and the judge said, yes, it's absolutely true. So a Dutch court has said to Shell, no, it's 2030, not 2050. So from the business governance perspective, this is a very serious thing. What can companies do? Well, how am I doing for time? Not very well, I'm afraid. Okay, well, then I'll leave this for questions, and I'll leave it there for you. And then what is important for companies?
It's very interesting, and we can actually discuss this on the table. And I'm certain that Eric Cheney has a lot to say about the subjects Belen was analyzing now. We asked him to go into anything that affects our conversations before COVID, which was climate change. So we are very interested in your thoughts pertaining to the trends we are seeing here. Martina talked about green tech. We always see technology as a possible solution, all this. But there's something else we wanted to posit. How can we strike a balance between the restrictions of energetic transition and sustainable development? So that's the key question. Where's the balance? Where's that middle point between which could give us a solution to both problems?
Thank you very much. And again, thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure. I think you are raising a very difficult question, so maybe I should shy away. You're asking the question, what is the optimal strategy, given that we have to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases, the most important one being carbon dioxide? So I will start with saying that we are doing it. Let's be a little bit positive. Over the last 20 years, the emissions of CO2 have declined, whatever is the way you measure them, through carbon footprint or national emissions from the territory. They have been declining in most developed economies, and Europe is doing even better than the US. So, over the last 20 years, we have done a good job, which is not enough, but we went into the right direction. Now, the key question is, to accelerate the reduction of emissions, how to do it at the least cost? We must do it. The sixth report from the IPCC is very clear. It confirms that the previous reports were right. There were some uncertainties, they have been removed. And the report tells us that if we really want to avoid the average temperature to rise above 2 degrees, I'm not even talking about 1.5, we need to go to net zero in 2050. So this is coming from science, and if we don't do it, the consequences will be really dire. Okay, so we have to do it. How to do it at the lowest cost? Well, there is an economic answer which came from an American economist in the 1930s. Pigou. He said, well, you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, and you have to have the polluters pay the price for the damages that they will impose to the community. Well, in the case of CO2, it's a bit difficult, because CO2 is a global negative externality. You are not polluting the river of your neighbor. You are polluting the atmosphere of all human beings and living creatures. So you have to do computations about the damages in the future of 1 ton of CO2 emitted today. A lot of work has been done, especially by William Nordhaus, who got the Nobel Award for that. But it's fair to say that there is a huge uncertainty about the future damages of carbon. So this theoretical solution, which would be to have a carbon price everywhere the same, first Brazil, India, and other countries refused to go for a carbon price at the Paris conference. And second, there is a huge objection, which is the uncertainty on the computation of the damages. So the second best solution is to say, okay, as far as we are concerned in Europe, we go to zero in 2050. And to be sure that we go to zero, we are going to force companies to buy the right to emit CO2. And the quota of CO2 are going to be computed so that they fall to zero in 2050. So by definition, we should be at zero in 2050, provided that all the sectors are subjected to this exchange of emitting rights, which is called the ETS, the emission trading system. So far, ETS is only for the big energy producers and heavy industries which are emitting a lot of CO2. But the plan of the European Commission, which I think has been by and large accepted by most EU countries, it's called Fit for 55, will introduce a second ETS for transportation and for housing. That will cover 80% of the economy, so maybe we will not be at 100%. Okay, that sounds like a good solution. We know where we go, and thanks to the ETS, we do it at the lowest possible cost. If a company has interest in emitting, well, okay, if you're profitable, you buy the rights. But if another company has a technology, in-house technology, which allows this company to reduce its emissions, then you sell the rights. So that's the best of the world in theory. With one big difficulty, which is that the ETS system introduces a new uncertainty. So we have left the uncertainty about the future damages, but we have created a new uncertainty, which is the price of carbon. 2 years ago, a ton of CO2 was priced at less than 20 euros. Now it is 65. And for companies which have to take decisions for long-term investment, not knowing what will be the price of carbon in the next 10 to 20 years, is something that is an impediment to take the right decisions. So it is counterproductive to have such a volatility in the price. So what is the solution to reach this compromise you're asking? I think it is to have, together with the European trading system, to have a carbon price path, or maybe a floor for the carbon price, which will send a very clear message to companies. We have set up a floor. To set up a floor, you need an independent authority, which I would call the European Carbon Authority, made of scientists, of economists, selected by an international jury, so that there is no question about its competence. So if you have a floor, then the ETS will fluctuate, but companies will know where the price of carbon will be at minimum in 10 or 20 years' time. That is probably the best solution. Now, of course, there is an elephant in the room, which is the consumers. In the end, even if companies have to buy the right to emit CO2, the consumer is paying the price. This is hidden. Nobody really wants to face it. Whether you have a carbon tax or companies paying for the right to emit, in the end, consumers are paying. Oh, I forgot something very important. If you have a carbon price through the ETS system for 80% of the economy, it has also to be the same for imported goods. So that is the carbon border adjustment mechanism. Instead of saying carbon tax at the border, it's CBAM. People don't want to say tax, it's a dirty word. So let's assume that we have this, and this is absolutely necessary to avoid to have different carbon prices and to have a level ground play field for companies. The carbon price is the same for imported goods. Okay, so consumers have to pay, but they don't like that. Each time you raise carbon taxes, you have the yellow jackets or another example of this kind of revolt, which is quite comprehensible. So the solution is to redistribute the proceeds of carbon taxes, of ETS proceeds, to the population. And I think the only way to do it is the subsidiarity principle. You get a lot of money which is collected by the European Union. The ETS, actually, it's a bit more than the European Union. There are some countries associated with it, but let's simplify it. You have carbon taxes, give it back to the people. And the decisions have to be taken by the countries themselves, by their constituencies, by their national parliaments. In my view, but that's the view of an economist, it would be smart to focus the redistribution of the carbon proceeds, let's call that the carbon dividend, to the lowest income, not to people who consume a lot of energy, because there is this temptation to avoid the yellow jackets revolt. It's okay, you have to pay, but on the other hand, we give you money. Well, in that case, you kill the incentive to go to low carbon products, whether they are cars or electronic appliances, whatever it is. So redistribute to the population, let countries decide how they want to redistribute. But there is another factor, which I think has been very well underlined by Martina and by Belen. If we want to get there, we need the technology. And the technology will be the result of basic research, applied research, and investment. So a part of the proceeds should be used precisely to fund the research that we need. Nobody knows today what will be the technologies in 20 years' time that we will be using to avoid emitting carbon. Maybe these technologies will come from basic research discoveries 10 years ago, and nobody's suspecting that because the time frame is very often 20 to 30 years between a fundamental or a basic discovery and its application in industry. So a part should be reallocated to research and to investment. That will not be sufficient. And that will be my last word. We need to invest a lot of money to decarbonize our economies. And it's not, you know, for doing good. It's to avoid catastrophes simply because Europe is big. Of course, China is even bigger and the US is even bigger. But with a carbon tax adjustment, since the European Union is by far the largest market for exporters, there is a very strong incentive for those countries to follow the same path. And by the way, the Chinese are starting an ETS, their own ETS. And in the US, unfortunately, Joe Biden, who was in favor of a carbon tax, is so scared, maybe by the French yellow jackets or by the difficulties of reaching a compromise within the Congress, that he has dropped the ball. But nevertheless, if we get there, we need to spend money. And to spend money, you need growth. And this is where you need to hire Bart Van Ark and ask him, how can we raise productivity? Inclusive, it's even better. But we need to raise productivity. We need to work more. This is as simple as that. But that is not sufficient. We need also to raise productivity. So that goes through all the ingredients that are needed to raise productivity, which are education, especially scientific education, where Europe, unfortunately, is lagging compared to Asian countries. The U.S. is also lagging, but they have nevertheless such strong potential in science that so far they are managing this lack of good education. It is professional training, occupational training. It is basic research, a lot of things on which I will not talk, but to find the solution to the challenge that you are asking, we need growth. Degrowth is exactly the opposite of what we need if we want to reach our targets in terms of fighting climate change.